Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
This is Tim Staples of Catholic Answers. I'm excited to let you know that I also teach high school apologetics for homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. There are also recorded independent learning courses at homeschoolconnections.com. Whether you take apologetics with me, literature with Joseph Pierce, or philosophy with Bill Donahue, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, it's a great way to get Catholic learning for your family.
This episode is brought to you by Hallo, the number one Catholic app. Hallo has 1,000 audio-guided prayers and meditations for you to deepen your relationship with God. To listen to all of the Hallo meditations for free for 30 days, head to hallo.com/breadbox.
Welcome to Live a Little. Today, I have a special guest for you who knows quite a bit about the Muslim world and history, and who has also lived in Turkey and visited many countries there. And I think you will appreciate his input and his wisdom and his knowledge on Islamization of Christian countries and evangelizing Muslims. And here today joining me, Bob Brenneman, and he is going to start us with a prayer. And then he will introduce himself. Thank you very much for joining us today, Bob.
Thank you. It's a very privilege to be here. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, we thank you, O Lord, for this chance to be together with those that are listening in. We do pray, Lord, you'd inspire each of us, Lord, to be more like Christ, to love our neighbors, and to especially those that might have contact with Muslims. We do pray they would show the love of Christ to them. And that we need to pray your blessings on Daria and her family, your wonderful children. And we thank you, Lord, for this time together. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
I'll just give a little bit of my background of how I got involved in this. It's been about a 40-year endeavor. 40 years ago or so, I was looking for God's will. I was a pastor of a small church in inner city Chicago, a very challenging task as it was, but my heart had always been to take the gospel abroad. At that time, Islam was not in the news. It was mostly the communist world. So I thought that I would do what some of my heroes did in those days, and that is to take Bibles into communist countries. They use the word smuggle sometimes, you know, smuggling good things, not contraband. And so I tried it in 1980, myself and two friends, we went and we tried to smuggle, take Bibles into the Soviet Union. We were caught with them. And I thought we were going to spend the rest of my life would be in Siberia, but they let us go after a few hours.
Wait, and, for eight Bibles? Did you say eight Bibles?
No, it was about 130 Bibles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's three of us and we got caught with them. We thought that they would do work like we read the books by Brother Andrew and others where God blinded the eyes of the guards. But for us, that did not happen. They caught us. And so
you fell through the cracks. God was a little cracks. Distracted, huh?
So, you know, that trip, we went to a number of Eastern Bloc countries. And our last country was not a communist country. It was Turkey. And I don't know why we put that on the agenda, but I was curious how this Turkey, how it could have all this Christian heritage and yet be Muslim now. I did not know what a Muslim was in those days. You know, it was, like I said, it wasn't the news in 1980 like it is now. And so as I began to pray about, Lord, where would you have us serve? I felt the Lord speak to me about Turkey and not Soviet Union or Hungary or Poland or any of these other countries. And so I got back and I told the people that sent us over that we were going to go to Turkey. And that's how I fell in love with it. I began to study the people and the language and the culture, the Christian heritage and history of it. And it's been, like I said, 40 years now of either being involved with Turkey or teaching others about sharing Muslims. I've been the last 21 or 22 years, I've been at a Christian university teaching, and the students all know that my heart will always be in Turkey. And, but I always will, I always try to share with them about loving Muslims and being there for them and along that line. So that's a little bit of a journey. I have three children and six grandchildren. So along the way, God blessed us. And it's been, like I said, about 40 years of working on this.
Oh, it's beautiful. I don't want to give away your age, which you already have with mentioning grandchildren. But so 40 years ago is around the time I was born. So Turkey was quite different back then. I would assume it's become more Islamicized since then. Have you been visiting regularly?
I go every year, almost every year. Missing a year going to Turkey is like tears me apart. I love it so much. And Turkey is like nowhere else in the world. I sure, Dara, as you're a Turk, maybe it's you could love it more or love it less. I'm not sure. But for me, a person who where I raised my children there. And I love it. I've lived other places, too. I lived in northern Iraq for 4 years. Mm-hmm. But Turkey is always what draws me like a magnet. I love the culture, the people, the nature, the food. There's not much about Turkey I don't like, except for the fact that, of course, it's been very, very hard for there to be a really strong Christian movement there. It's been quite resistant to the gospel for a number of reasons, what we can maybe talk about later. But
which is interesting because it's a very, like, as a culture, as a people, we are very warm-blooded, warm-hearted. We are hospitable. You will think all of these characteristics would make the gospel easier to penetrate, but it's nothing like that. Again, we will talk about it in a little bit, how, as you say, Asia Minor, today's Turkey, mm-hmm. was Christian. That's where St. Paul evangelized first. I used to take Christian teenagers for hiking trips on St. Paul's Trail. Have you ever been there? It's like, yes, along the south, and it's treacherous and beautiful, and just imagine that St. Paul walked those roads, mm-hmm. to, you know, like evangelize the Romans. It's just amazing. And, you know, here 2,000 years later, it's completely different. Of course, it was different, you know, about 1,000 years ago. So mainly I would like to, before we talk about why it's so resistant to the gospel, I'd like to talk about how it became Muslim. Mm. Because as you say, still a lot of Westerners don't have an understanding of history of those lands. And I think partly because, especially in America, we kind of learn Protestant history. Mm-hmm. So there is like this 1,500-year gap in between, which is when it happened, you know, when everything changed. So if you could walk us through how what happened, and of course Islam started in Saudi Arabia, and how it spread, and how it reached Asia Minor and, you know, even Africa, that would sure. be wonderful.
Well, I go back to Acts, the second chapter. It's the outpouring of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. 3,000 people are converted under the Apostle Peter's preaching, and the church is birthed. This wonderful celebration. And it mentions in that portion of scripture, Acts, the second chapter, verses 9 through 11, it mentions 15 distinct places or people. Mm-hmm. It mentions Mesopotamia, which is today's Iraq. It mentions Parthia, which is in Iran today, Elam, which is in Iran. It mentions the Medes, which are probably the ancestors of the present-day Kurdish people, by far the largest minority in Turkey, and also very large minorities in Iran, Iraq, and Syria as well. It mentions Egypt, of course, which is predominantly Muslim. So of the 15 people groups in Acts 2, 12 of them are now predominantly Muslim. And it mentions 5 places there in Turkey. My favorite place in the whole world is probably Cappadocia, Turkey. Some people call it mm-hmm. Cappadocia. Turks call it Cappadocia. And it's to me, it's the most amazing place on earth. The exotic formations of cave churches dug underground when the Christians had to hide from the Romans and later from the Arabs. They went underground, sometimes 5 and 7 stories under the ground, and lived there for months. And they you know, these incredible things. And so 5 of these places are in Turkey. And then if you look at who these people are today, they're primarily of the 4 major ethnic groups in the Islamic world today. Arabs, of course, are by far the largest. And of course, it's through the Arabs that Islam came. It mentions Parthia and Elam, which are the Persians of today. It mentions mm-hmm. the Kurds, if they truly are the, and I did my doctoral research on this topic, if they truly are the descendants of the biblical Medes, And then five of the places are in Turkey. Now, Turks did not become Muslim right away. They were the last ones of these four groups to become predominantly Muslim. So we'll have to look at their history just a tad differently. But with time, those four groups started well. Thomas is one of my heroes. I think the Apostle Thomas does not give enough credit. He's actually the one that took the gospel into Iraq and Persia and all the way to India before he was most likely killed in India. And he gets very little credit today because most of his work was outside of the West. Of course, Paul preached the gospel in Turkey mostly, and other apostles did as well. And so the church was birthed, and the seven churches from the book of Revelation are in Turkey. Antioch, where Paul was born, or where Paul and Barnabas started those churches, the first missionary journeys of Paul started in Antioch. It was kind of the multicultural area of the time. My daughter-in-law is actually from that area. She's a Turkish person that lives from Antakya. Today it's called Antioch. So I've been there many times. And so this incredible heritage, bro, places like Ephesus, Galatia, Colossia, all these places mentioned in the scripture are in Turkey today. So how they became Muslim it's been an interesting but also kind of agonizing study. And then, of course, we look at Persia, Iran today. We look at Iraq. We look at Central Asia. All those are predominantly Muslim countries where these descendants of Pentecost started. As Islam came in six centuries later, gradually the church gave way. And how that happened and why that happened, I think, is, a big thrust of what I'm working my research is now.
No, that's beautiful. I had never thought about it going back to Pentecost because, it's those people's names. They're just so unfamiliar. We kind of read it and glance over it. We don't read it. Like, I never thought that what has become of these people. So that's really interesting that so many of them have actually turned Muslim. Have you read about, this is like a slight tangent, but have you read about Muslims kind of tracing themselves? Muhammad always traced himself back to Ishmael. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if that's factual at all. Have you looked into that?
I have. I've kind of just taken, it could be questioned. I try to give it, kind of the benefit of the doubt and say, if Arabs trace their ancestry back to Hagar and it does seem like in Genesis, there is some mention of Arabs seem to come from three places, from Abraham and Hagar, and then from Ishmael went through there. And there's also a time after Abraham remarried again, after his wife died, even though he's well over 100, there's also several tribes that are mentioned that are Arabs today. And there's also one that's also mentioned, I think it's in Genesis 11. And I don't have it right at my fingertips here, but the ancestors of the Arabs seem to be Peleg is the ancestor of the Hebrews. And of course, the Arabs are a Semitic people, as the Hebrews are. So I think those are the three places that probably the Arabs came from. And of course, with time, as Arabic became so strong, these other people groups that you read about in the Bible, Hittites and Jebusites and all these different peoples that the Israelites encountered, probably Arabized. And a lot of them are just, as Arabic became the language in the Middle East, they just called themselves Arabs. Of course, the Berbers would be part of that area throughout North Africa. And so more and more people just Arabized with time. And, the same way as you might have also with Persia, you had the Elamites and the Parthians. Well, those were gradually absorbed into Persian identity and so on. So, as Islam spread, it moved a lot of directions, but it does seem like it ethnically, some of these smaller groups were just absorbed into the major ethnic conglomerates. Now, what you mentioned, Daria, about the Acts, I've probably heard, I've been a Christian since 1971 when I was a college freshman. How many sermons have I heard in the book of Acts? I mean, hundreds and hundreds. I've never heard anybody talk about what happened to those people in Acts 9 through 11 until I started researching it. They go right around, oh, wonderful day, 3,000 were converted, the day the church began, and it's all like that. But what happened to those people? 12 of the 15 are now Muslim. The only ones that are not are, is Jerusalem, Judea. It mentions Rome, and it mentions Crete. is Greek Orthodox. Rome, of course, is the center of Catholicism, and Jerusalem is Jerusalem, you know, center for Judaism as well, as although a lot of Muslims and Christians live there as well. So I think that's been a neglect, as you said. We haven't studied those origins, and then what happened? Why did they become Muslim? You know, how could these people have eventually Islamicized when they had this Christian heritage? That's the issue that I've really been trying to get a handle on.
I know, it's amazing. And I don't think it's quite, I don't think it's spread as far until the Turks came into stage, right? Arabs usually kind of moved to the west through Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, the Turks were definitely the ones that really brought it into the world. They basically took over the Arabs after a while. The Arabs were starting to degenerate somewhat culturally, getting pretty complacent. Of course, in the early days, the Arabs were all the way into Spain. It took Spain. And then they were defeated when they were getting ready to take France and the Battle of Tours in 732. If that battle, if it wasn't for Charles Martel, who's one of those unappreciated heroes today, all of Europe could easily have been Muslim. That was the first really major defeat they had. And so they were kind of driven out of Europe besides Spain. Spain stayed Islamic for another 700 years. But the Turks then were, they were kind of in between religions, it seems like. You know, they heard along the Silk Road where the Turks were living, there was a lot of Buddhists and there was some Nestorian Christians, and I won't get into the whole thing, what made Nestorian Christians unique at that point. And of course, Muslims started to surface. And it just seemed like, and that the Islam seemed to fit the Turks. Both Buddhism and Christianity are kind of, in those days especially, are world denying faiths. I mean, celibacy was a very high virtue, and a lot of them withdrew in the world, lived in monasteries now, where the Muslims were world affirming. I mean, they went out and conquered. They had multiple wives. It was probably more appealing to those people that lived in much more of a style that they could identify with the Islamic lifestyle, with the Arabs, and much more than they probably could with the world denying face of Buddhism. And unfortunately, at that time, a lot of Christianity was world denying. And so by the time the Turks converted, it wasn't all overnight. There was Turkish Christians that lasted quite a while. You know, there's still a small remnant that are still Turkish Christians that never converted. But with time, by the 11th century, they were solidly Islamic, and they had started invading Eastern Turkey and won a major battle in we call it Malazgirt today, but it's Manuskirt in history books. And they got a foothold there. I think it was in 1071, if I remember right. And from that, over the next 400 to 500 years, they started working their way west toward the big prize, which is Constantinople. Today, of course.
The biggest part of it, as you say, Turks were nomadic people that we've been traveling from. Bernadette is joining us today with occasional cries and fusses.
That's all right.
Because they were driven away by the Chinese, basically. So they traveled across as the Huns, right? Turks are descendants of the Huns. So they kind of spread around across Asia. And the Turks ended up going south and becoming Muslim. And the one that kind of went a little north of the Black Sea, they, as you say, is a very small group who remained Christian. But when the Turks came down to the towards the Muslim lands, as you say, it feels like perfect fit, because we are kind of warrior-like nomadic people back then. They hadn't settled yet. They were looking for a place to settle. And as you say, neither Buddhism nor Christianity is very keen on like waging wars and conquering. And it's completely different expectations than Islam. So as you say, it was just this perfect collusion of two cultures. And Islam, of course, justified all the warmongering in a way, right? Like you can go and conquer in the name of Islam. You can call it bounty. And they didn't really quite settle until the Ottomans. So they were always on the move. They were always tribal, and which was also a big change. So what happened once they reached Jerusalem, basically? So the Seljuk Turks. So
I think you're making a very good point there, because if you know, I think Islam doesn't, it promises bounty in this life. And if you do die in the jihad, you're guaranteed paradise without having to account for your sin. So you could easily say to your warriors, you have nothing, absolutely nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. If you live, the bounty of these people is their ears, their women are yours, their children, you know, their wealth is yours. If you die, you go right to paradise where you have the virgins and you have these promises. And so they were warriors, were remarkably brave in those days. The Turks, you know, having recently converted, they always had that zeal, the new converts, you know, pretty much. And they ended up basically, and that's, there's a lot of history there. I probably won't have time to go into all of it, but they basically, as I mentioned, dominated the Islamic world with the Ottoman Empire as the Arabs kind of receded. And of course, the Arabs lived under Turkish rule too, North Africa and most of the Middle East, as well as much of Europe and of course, today's Turkey. So the Turks just, you know, they took their warrior tradition and Islam kind of allowed them to do that. And part of the problem, I think, too, Derry, was the Christians were so deeply divided. And again, we can't go through all the different things that they probably faced, but they were divided a lot over the person of Christ. How could Jesus be both God and man? And so one group thought he was, you know, they thought he separated the divinity from his humanity too far, and they were considered heretical. Well, those people that you consider heretics were the Nestorians, who took the gospel, were the missionary heroes of their day. They took the gospel as far as China, but yet they were considered heretics by the Orthodox Catholic majority at this time, which they had not divided yet. The Catholics and the Orthodox did not divide from each other until the 11th century, and there were no Protestants for another five centuries after that. So forget Protestants here. They're not even in the picture yet. And Catholic and Orthodox were still one at this point, and they rejected the Nestorians as separating the natures of Christ too far. Then another group came in out of Egypt and other places, and they felt like they didn't give enough attention to Jesus' humanity, and they were considered heretical. And so the Christians were fighting a lot. And then Muslims came along with a very simple, you know, just pay a tax, you know, and submit to Muslim rule, you know, and yeah, they didn't make them have to pick on these issues. And over a period of time, Muslims got a foothold, and sometimes even these people welcomed the Muslims that thought they would be better than to serve under their so-called Christian rulers, which is really a tragic story to have to read. But of course, with time, they became much more oppressive. But this first started out, a lot of people actually welcomed the Muslim invaders, the Arabs invaders. They said they don't care what we believe about Christ. They don't see us as heretics. They see us all kind of as heretics, but they don't force us to believe in any other way. And so that was one of the things that happened. And with time, as the Arabs came into those lands, you know, from all across North Africa and the Middle East, they usually were outnumbered. That people did not convert overnight. Most places took at least a couple hundred years. But as they paid the tax, it's called the jizya, as they paid mm-hmm. the tax and had to dress separately from the Muslims, often could not ride horses. They had to ride donkeys. They had to get off the sidewalk when a Muslim passed by. They could not convert a Muslim, but a Muslim could convert them. Muslims could marry their women, but Christians could not marry a Muslim woman. With time, it just became more simple. You know, it just became simpler to convert. I tell a story in my book about, let's take a young man. Let's say he's 15 years old, and he goes to his dad and says, "Dad, why are we Christian?" And if it's, you know, it says the Arabs seem to win all the military battles, or the Muslims, they, you know, they have all these advantages. What is the purpose of why we do this? Why are we resisting it? You know, my friends kind of make fun of me. They say we worship three gods, you know, and he goes through all these things. His father just simply says, "Well, son, you know, maybe God's punishing us for our unfaithfulness." But his son says, "What if Islam is true? Maybe that's why we're losing these battles." And so there's, you know, right there, you know, you have the, maybe the father will stay Christian, you know, but the son may convert with time. And of course his children will stay Muslim. And so over a period of time, the Turks went from being, well, the Muslims, I shouldn't say Turks, but here so much, it's more, still more Arabs at this early days of Islam. But you would have this situation where with time, even though it could sometimes a couple hundred years, each country was a little slower in how the rates they converted. None of them were overnight, but over a period of living under, they call them Dahimis in those days. Dahimis were the subjected minorities under Islamic rule, Jews and Christians, mostly people of the book, with time, they gradually see those statistics go up and up and up until they became, gradually Christians became a small minority. And so Turkey, same with Anatolia, with Turkey, you know, as the Turks came in at first, the Greeks, they're mostly Greeks and Armenians and Assyrians in those days. They didn't convert overnight. They stayed what they were. And until World War One, a lot of Turkey was still Christian. But with time, once again, there's more and more pressure and different things happened. And most of those people now are Muslims.
Yeah, I actually wrote something about how the Ottomans handled Christian problem, so to speak, because as you say, it's not just with the sword. Like, you know, they used to say it's easier to conquer China than rule China. So I think it was like that with the Christians, especially like the Ottomans. They came and, you know, Turkey is the size of Texas, so it's not a small country.
No, not at all.
Especially, yeah, it's especially considered to most European countries. So yeah, you can come and conquer it, but there's all these Christian peoples who have been Christians for 1,000 years by then. So like, how do you rule them? And Turks did it really well in a way that, as you say, it's not like just throw all the Christians into boiling water. Instead, they slowly, they chipped at their resistance to convert, as you say. And they relocated a lot of Christians. So that's kind of when you shuffle people around, mix Muslims with Christians. Islam is such a dominant culture and religion. And as you say, as they mean, they didn't have that many rights anyway. So it's like, how long can you resist at the end of the day? Like, this is, it's hard. I mean, you can see the same idea. Like, as you speak, I'm seeing like this secularist society doing the exact same thing to today's church, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you try to raise your kids Christians, Catholics, but the culture is so anti-Christian that it's like one day the kid asks, why are we Christian? And if he's not, you know, if he doesn't get the right answers, or if the secular culture is more to his taste, we don't know people's hearts, you know, so then they will fall away. So it's, in a way, it's a similar occurrence back in the day. Like, now it's secularism, back then it was Islam. Because how long can you resist the dominant culture? Like, you need to have strong faith, strong formation, strong foundation, and a community, which Muslims pretty much made sure that it doesn't happen. So even now, when you go to most Muslim countries, like, the communities are small and very hush-hush. They don't make noise. They try not to attract attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, they're like surviving, right? Like, they're not thriving, you know, they're surviving. So I think, as you say, they've done really well in that slowly kind of chipping away at the sharp edges of the Christian culture, and people fell away slowly. So I want to talk a little bit about the Crusades, because when I was reading the, I got an email from someone who was stationed in Turkey a while ago, mm-hmm. during Cold War, and he said his friend, so American gentleman, and he and his friend were in this like a small city, it's called Amasya in Turkey, and they wandered into a movie theater for some reason. I don't know, they clearly don't speak Turkish. So they were watching this movie, and they could see it was one of those old crusade movies. Have you seen any of those while even Turkey? So it's like all the bad guys are crusaders, and they wear the crusader tabard and the shield, and they're raping women and killing children, and they were all evil. And he said people started to take their shoes off and throw them at the screen, and they were booing the screen. And he and his friend looked at each other, is like, how many Christians do you think are there in this movie theater? And they were like, two. So they kind of, you know, scattered through the side door. So I'm like, I want to talk about the Crusades and how that came about. Obviously, the Turks play a big role in that. And then how it's still alive, right? Like, you know, we are still holding on to it in Turkey. Like, it's so hard for Americans to understand that this is still, like, that's last year's file. You got to move on from that. Like, no, like, it's still a big deal in Muslim land. So, which is about the time frame we are. So, the Arabs move and the Turks arrive. And what happens with the Crusades, if you can just recap very quickly for us.
It seemed like, and unfortunately, because I love the Turks so much, it's unfortunate that this happened. But the Arabs kind of let the Christians do pilgrimages to Turkey, even though they controlled the lands, including the holy places. They let Christians make pilgrimage. But the Turks, being much more zealous for Islam, again, it's their early days of their conversion, they really started oppressing a lot of the pilgrims that went. And so in about 1095, the Pope declared it was God's will to take the lands back for the Holy Church. And thousands of crusaders left Northern Europe primarily and marched down toward Jerusalem. What people don't realize is there's probably a majority of people. I mean, there was a different reasons, different motivations. Some gave everything up to go fight. They really thought they were doing God's will. They gave everything up. They never saw their families again. Or if they saw them, it was years and years later. They left their wealth. Others were scumbags. I guess we use colloquial language. They just wanted to go and get some adventure and, you know, maybe rape and kill. But the thing that almost never gets done is that almost all the time, it's the Christians that take the blame for the Crusades, not realizing that when did the Crusades really begin? Did they begin in the 11th century or did they begin in the 7th century when Islam took over all the lands of that used to be Christian? But you almost never see that. And even in American secular, you know, history books, it's always all the blame goes almost on the Crusaders. And I think this is something that's, you know, I think it's political correctness and other factors that play into that. But it's, I tell my students, I said, you know, Christians will apologize for some terrible things that have happened in history, slavery that they were involved in, different things like this have happened. But I've never seen Muslims ever apologize for either for the Crusades or apologizing for having slaves or apologizing for the tens of millions of people over the years that were raped and killed and forced to become Muslim or die, this kind of thing. That I've never seen any apology for it. So it's a very different way of looking at things. Right. And so I think with time, as the Crusaders came, it was the Crusades last over 200 years. And for the most part, it was ugly. Probably the glorious part of one of the few glorious parts of the Crusades was St. Francis of Assisi, who tried to bring peace. And he marched between the Christian and the Muslim armies in Egypt and called them both to repentance and ended up living in, you know, with the Sultan stayed with the Sultan for several days. And so the Sultan was so impressed by him that he almost converted despite the battle going on outside of his tent. And there was a couple other people like Raymond Lull who preached the love of Christ in the Crusades. And there were other people, a few. But for the most part, it was a very ugly time in our history, in Christian history, no question. But I do think it's been overblown so much that it was all the Crusaders' fault and not realizing that the Crusades also were fought 500 years before that, when their lands were invaded by the Muslim armies. And so this was kind of like when they quit letting them make these pilgrimages and that's when the Pope said, okay, this is enough. And declared this, you know, of course, global jihad. Also only 50 years before that, the Eastern Church and Western Church divided. So there were some bad feelings in that way too. And so some of the Crusaders went not only to oppress the, you know, not to fight against the Muslims, they killed Jews along the way, some of them. And they also, sometimes they got in fights with Eastern Christians who they saw as heretical. And sometimes the Eastern Christians then retaliated and did not aid the Crusaders. They called them to come and help them. And then when the Crusaders came from the West, the Eastern Christians did not aid them. And so the Crusaders took the loss of life that way. So it was just ugliness on all sides. One last thing I'll mention this, Daria, is that I think it was the late 1990s, a group of several hundreds, and is it ultimately several thousand altogether, started to make an apology for the Crusades and went from Frankfurt, Germany, where they started, or Cologne, Germany, and started walking toward Jerusalem and apologized for the Crusades along the way. And they apologized mostly to Jews and to Muslims. They went to mosques and synagogues saying, our forefathers misrepresented Christ to you. This is not what his message is about. And yeah, it was mixed. It's received by mixed. Some say it was 1,000 years ago. Why it wasn't necessary. Other people felt it was, you know, spot on. But be as it may, I think there's been a lot more coming to grips with it. And as one writer points out, Rodney Stark, who's a brilliant sociologist of religion, he says is that the Muslims never made a big deal out of the Crusades. It was just another battle for them. You read their histories back in that time period. So we had some battles. It wasn't until the 19th century, anti-Christian intellectuals in Europe really are the ones that called the Crusades to account. And they may put all the blame on the Crusaders because they hated the church. They hated Catholicism. They hated the church. And they put all the blame almost on the Crusaders, not the Muslims, but it's the intellectual Europeans,
Right, because as far as Muslims are concerned, hey, it's like Jerusalem. It's your holy city, my holy city. It's up for grabs. Like whoever gets it. And I think one of the things, especially in the Muslim lands, and especially in Turkey, obviously, because there's a lot of Turkish history there, they used was when the new republic was formed, they needed a source to unify behind. So it was almost like, so we borrowed all these Western ideals, right? You know, the Turkish people started to dress like at gunpoint, forcefully dressed like the Westerners, you know, the fez and the headscarf was banned and all that stuff. So we're getting all these Western ideals, but it's so external, so foreign to Turks, that it's almost like they created this boogeyman with Christianity. So, I mean, obviously they are the Islam and Christianity are at odds. They've always been. But after the Turkish Republic was born, it's like all this sinister boogeyman that's out to get us. We better unite or they're just going to tear us apart. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and Crusades are a big part of that boogeyman. It's like, look what they did then. You think it's going to be any different now? And that's one of the reasons when you convert to Christianity in Turkey, you're considered a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're one of the boogeymen. Like, we can't trust you anymore. So, I think that's why Crusades are still such a big deal. I mean, I don't know if for Arabs, if it's a big deal or not still. Like, I'm just not familiar as much. But definitely in Turkey still, it's thought as the Christians came and conquered the Holy Land. Also, you need to remember in Islam, and if once a land is Muslim, like it's forever Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
They will never rescind their claim to it. So it's like a different way of seeing territory and warfare. Okay, so then came the Ottomans after the Crusades, and that's when most of Asia Minor fell. So I want to talk about the Ottoman Empire a little bit.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire was interesting in a lot of ways. One last thing about the Crusades, I think, that we have to remember is I think a lot of times everything that is associated with the West can be seen as a Crusade, not just military. So when Western pop culture, especially in Turkey, that emulated so much Western culture at one time, not as much as they used to, but that could be seen as a Crusade. They're not trying to conquer, but corrupt Muslim youth. I've seen that before. I'll never forget the horror that I saw when Madonna was in her peak. She did a concert that was on Turkish TV, and she did about everything you could name that was immoral in that concert. I didn't want to describe it.
I think she's Christian, right?
And she had a big cross around her, between her very exposed breasts the whole time.
Right.
And I saw that, this is Crusades. They're not conquering, but they're corrupting.
Right.
And movies that were corrupting. And so it became not just military, but also anything that comes from the West that's out to seduce Muslim youth was seen as crusades. I think what you mentioned about the Arabs, they also had the Crusades too, but I think they were more colonialism. They lived under the British and French, whereas the Turks were never really colonized to the same degree. And so the Turks had more of the Crusaders go back further, but the colonial era that after the Crusades, when England and France basically divide up the Middle East, they divide up the Arab world arbitrarily, which was tragic. I think that weighs more with the Arabs than the Crusades do. Although it's a Crusade,
Definitely that makes sense and leaves a more lasting mark than the Crusades, I'd say.
So the Ottomans, I mean, they started working their way west from 1071 up until the big prize was Istanbul. And that year, 1454, was the fatal year when Istanbul finally, after 22 attempts to make it fall, fell. And it goes back, what I understand, and is a Hungarian weapons maker invented a cannonball that was so powerful that it could destroy the walls. As long as the Christians could stay behind the walls in Constantinople, again, it's Istanbul today, the walls are still there, they felt safe, even though the whole area around them became Muslim under Turks. And they went even west of that in much of Europe. What's today Bulgaria, Romania, parts of Hungary, that whole area there, the Balkans, a lot of that came under Islamic rule, but they could never take Constantinople. And mm-hmm. So this Hungarian weapons maker then tried to sell it to the Christians. He was a Christian, and they wouldn't buy it. And so he sold it to the Ottomans. And with this young Sultan Mehmet, who was only 21 years of age, he came up with these brilliant plans to defeat to take over. I don't want too much detail here, but between the cannonballs assaulting the city, and then even though the Byzantines had this a lot of ways of blocking the ships. They controlled the Bosphorus Straits. The Turks bypassed the Straits and carried their ships on Greece bottoms over the Golden Horn and were able to bypass the sea blockade of the Byzantine Christians there. And so eventually when Istanbul fell, I think it was 1453, excuse me. And that was a huge turning point. That's what a lot of people thought was over. Christianity could never survive. It was the most important city for 1,000 years. The most important church became a mosque.
It's the new Rome, years. Right? Yeah. Like it's the new Rome.
The so new Rome, sounds, yeah. Rome itself was, Rome was important, don't get me wrong. But I mean, in a lot of ways, Byzantine was more important than Rome was as far as, because it was east, further east. It reached all those people there. And it was a center of the Christian world. It's where the Russians converted. They came into Hagia Sophia, that great church. And so this is as close to heaven as ever get on this earth. And that's when the Slavic peoples converted to Christianity. I mean, it just had this, that's where a lot of the church councils took place, where they defined a lot of our Christian doctrine was defined there. I mean, when that church became a mosque, it was a blow that a lot of people thought, we can never recover from. And so when it recently became a mosque again under Erdogan, you can see why it was so much mourning about it, because for a lot of the people, it was after being a museum for the last numbers of years under Ataturk, now it's a mosque again. You can see why it was such a day of mourning for a lot of Christians expressed as a day of mourning.
Right, because the conquest of Istanbul, Constantinople was like, it wasn't just a political affair. Obviously, Ottomans loved the power, and Constantinople was an excellent place to, spread further, because what geared the Ottomans was this spread, right? Like this, where they get their bounty, that's where they got the empire got its energy almost. So like once we couldn't spread anymore, it started to decline.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Istanbul was such an important, and also Muhammad himself has said that whoever conquered Constantinople would be blessed, like Jerusalem and Constantinople, two very, very important cities. But it's also religious, right? So it's like, a lot of people see it as this, the religious aspect is separate from the political aspect. Like, people didn't think that way back in the day. These are all intertwined each other. Like, otherwise, why would he go in and turn this beautiful, beautiful church cathedral into a mosque? Obviously, it's a religious statement. And still, most Muslims think that way. Like, they don't separate politics and religion. This is like this is with secularist Western invention. Like, they're intertwined. We see, in Christianity, we have a distinction between the temporal and the spiritual realm, but in Islam, there is no such distinction. Mm-hmm. So, like, every political act is also a religious statement. So you just always need to read the history through those lenses. And Erdogan knows that. That's why it's like he, like, why would you do that? He, first of all, wanted to keep the attention from himself because he's overall a failing president. But also he wants to bring that, like, combine that political and religious aspect back again in Turkey. And also he wants to be Sultan.
Yeah, like, no question. You know, it's interesting, you know, Daria, I thought about the mentality, you know, why the Christians, if they went back to the Old Testament, they could probably say there's two reasons why we're losing. Either we've displeased God, you know, and so therefore God's allowing our enemies to triumph over us. And I look at how the Christians might have interpreted that, all these losses to Islam. Well, they could have either said God must be on their side, therefore we might as well convert, or they could have said this is God's punishment on us, and they stayed Christian as Dahimi. And then in a little bit after Istanbul fell, about 100 years later, 1571, if I remember my dates right, the Battle of Lepanto took place, where the Ottoman Turks lost a sea battle after 24 hours, I think it was, of praying the rosary. And the Christians united in that area and prayed the rosary, and they won a major battle with far more Turkic losses than there were Christian losses. And for a lot of people, that restored the faith that maybe God had not totally abandoned the Christians. And then they won two more battles against the Ottomans, trying to take Vienna, including their greatest of all rulers, Suleiman the Magnificent. He was defeated. And then later, another Kara Mustafa was defeated. And those two losses, you know, that, at that time, then the Ottomans no longer tried to conquer new area. And they start gradually, as you mentioned, already, they start decreasing in power. And with time, they became the sick man of Europe. But they controlled so much of Europe at that point. And it wasn't until World War One that there was the final defeat of the Ottoman Empire. And then the secular government of Turkey under Kemal Ataturk came into being, a whole different, which is a whole different topic. But the whole thing that the Ottomans did that was probably both good and bad in one sense was they divided people not by ethnicity, but by religion. So there was Orthodox Milets, and they call them Milets, you know, nations. And there's Protestant and Catholic Milets and basically Jewish, and they governed that way. And so you could stay, they had their own religious rulers that could make the laws for the people, for their own religion, as far as prayer and devotion, that kind of thing. But of course they had to submit to the Turkic rule as far as the areas that were not governed by local churches or synagogues. And that was kind of both a mixed in blessing and maybe in some ways was more tolerant. In some ways, I think the Ottomans deserve a lot of respect that way. But other ways, it wasn't so peaceful. It wasn't so respectful. With time, as Western Europe's ideas and America's ideas got to Anatolia more, people started identifying more with the West. And so you had different people came in, opened up schools for the minority children. And so the Christian children were getting educated. They were learning foreign languages. And then gradually the Ottomans wanted the same thing. And so they would send their kids to Christian schools in those days as well. But with time, it caused this uprising, and you began to see a rise of nationalism among the Christians. And that kind of paved the way for some of the atrocities that happened later that happened in the Ottoman Empire and then early in the afterwards. That led to the decline of Christianity, going from 20-30% of the population down to way under 1% today. A lot of things happened. It's just a packed with history in so many ways. We need books that explain all this. You know, you sort of can't do all of it.
I know, but it's overwhelming. Like, it's thousands of years, and it's like such a foreign idea for most Westerners. And it's amazing that Turkey is one of the most homogeneous countries ethnically and religious. It's amazing because, I mean, there was also Armenian genocide, dare we say genocide, lest Erdogan hears us. But, you know, so, and also the, really, I forgot the term. It's just all these pregnancies are killing my brain cells, I think. the population exchange, there it is.
Oh, the population exchange between Greece and Turkey, yeah.
Yes, I mean, you know, all these Greeks who lived in today's Turkey, who were like, they spoke Turkish, they were just Christian. They were uprooted, sent to Greece, and all these Muslims who've been living there for centuries were uprooted and brought to Turkey. So it's like this kind of, like you, again, dividing people according to their, you know, religion. And here we are, and Turkey became so, so hostile to the gospel in the end. So that's what happens in these lands. Like, it's not just in Turkey, which is a really secular country compared to other,
yes,
other Muslim countries. You know, like I never had to wear a headscarf in Turkey. Maybe I couldn't wear shorts or sleeveless shirt, but you know, I could wear jeans and a shirt, right? Like, which is kind of unthinkable. I could drive. I got all my education in Turkey except my PhD. So it's like it's a lot more different in Turkey. Yet the gospel, like, it's a very hard soil. Like, you know, you sow these seeds, you sow these seeds, not Catholics, but mostly, you know, Protestant missionaries, and there isn't much yield. So can you give us an insight why it is so hard?
Well, I think part of it, Daria, is just the very fact that Turkey has not seen the negative side of Islam to the same degree. Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey, did not care for Islam. I mean, I know they tried to make him look like he was a good Muslim, but I mean, that's stretching the truth. He was not. He wanted to totally secularize Turkey. He wanted to get rid of the Islamic sheikhs. He outlawed the headscarf. He outlawed headgear for men. He did all he could to break the mosque. Going to the mosque, he did everything he could to secularize, make it a modern state. With that in mind, then Turkey, you know, Islam has not been oppressive. In fact, I created some students' master's thesis when I was teaching at Luther Seminary, and one of my students was a Turkish woman, and was very devout Muslim, and she wrote a paper on how much discrimination women that wear a headscarf, the hijab, face. Yeah, in Turkey, a lot of them lost their jobs because they refused not to wear a headscarf. Just the opposite.
That's how it was when I was young. Like, you couldn't go.
You couldn't wear it. If you worked in a state office, you couldn't wear a headscarf. If you were a student, you could not wear one. So they said, we went to America and got our master's and doctorate degrees, and we wore a headscarf. We go back to Turkey, a Muslim country, we're not allowed to wear it. And so it just seemed like, so in other words, Islam in Turkey has not been very oppressive. You go to Iran, where people are very open to the gospel, it's because they're reacting against Islam so much. About every person you meet from Iran is open to the gospel. Well, why? Because they've seen Islam for face to face. It was forced on them. And more and more, as you mentioned earlier, we were talking privately, ISIS has driven lots of people away from Islam because of that. They're seeing the worst part of Islam now, and they're reading verses in the Quran that seem to justify what ISIS is doing. Most people had never heard those verses before, those jihad verses. They had no idea that was really in the Quran. And so I think
what you're... Quran, like people read the Bible, you know, it's just,
And so I think with Turkey, it's just been a matter of, it's just, Islam isn't seen as oppressive to, like, it might be in other places. It's just been it's been more like the West, where you have Christianity as part of who we are, and we're Christian, yes, but nobody, we don't take it too seriously. Some do, a small percentage do, of course, but most people do not, and so it's not been forced on them. And I think that's one reason. There's also the history, of course, between the West and Turkey that's not been very pretty. So, I mean, there's a number of reasons why I think the Turks have not been responsive to the gospel as much as maybe some other, even some Muslim peoples have been. But a lot of it, I think, is historical, and it's misperception, and it's the fact that, as I mentioned, Islam has not been as oppressive. It's been a much milder, kinder Islam than you would have. And so the identity is so much wrapped, isn't it? To be a Turk is to be a Muslim. Do you practice it? No, but that's who I am, because I'm a Turk. I'm a Kurd. I'm a Muslim. It's much stronger than it is among, I think, other people, perhaps, that it's their identities wrapped up in their faith, even if they don't practice it.
I see. Okay. I never thought about it. Because I've never been to to the Arab Muslim nation. So I just can't tell. I mean, I know enough from a distance, but you know, that's true. It's like, if you have never experienced how oppressive it is, which probably is changing in the recent years, And as you said, like one of the things that I hear over and over about ISIS is if anything, it brought people to question Islam. Like, is this true? Is this what they say true? You know, and everything that ISIS said, declared, they were all in the Hadith or in the Quran. And I'm like, yeah, they're not really making it up. It's all in there. So I think a lot of people kind of at least started to question Islam, which is, again, a big no-no because it's the religion of fear. I heard, I don't know how much you know, I heard that there is a big big demand for for gospel in Iran. Is that true? How much do you know about it?
Well, I'm not allowed to go, you know, I have not been to Iran. I've been on the border many, many times. I've talked to lots of Iranians and other countries. It's my number one country I'd like to visit someday. But it's hard for Americans to get visas there. And if you do, you're in a tour and you can't really get out and talk with people, usually. Mm-hmm. But almost everybody, and there's many, many Iranians that come to Turkey. And for example, I was in a hotel one time and I meet these people and they're from Iran and we spend the day together and we don't talk too much seriousness, but they said, we have some friends coming the next day. And so they came, they introduced me to them. And the woman says, the first thing she says before she even said hello was, do you have a Bible? And in Farsi. And I gave her one and her and her husband read it all night. And the next day they went to the church. There's one of the churches in Istanbul has Iranians, Persian Farsis church service. They call Farsis the language of Iran. Mm-hmm. And they gave their hearts, you know, to the Lord and just, you know, God, they were dancing with joy. They were, you know, both Protestants, Catholics use the phrase baptized in the Holy Spirit. They were baptized in the Holy Spirit, all that in one day. I mean, it's just like they were so hungry for it. Right. And I've never seen it happen with a church. I mean, that kind of response, that open, you know, I've seen it happen more than once. Quick stories of people that are coming to faith almost with no persuasion. There's none of the, well, the Bible's been changed like usually here in Turkey or right. Jesus. The Christians worship three gods, you know, the Trinity, misunderstanding the Trinity, or Jesus did not die on a cross, somebody else did. You don't hear that with Iranians for the most part. How do I find Jesus? You know, it's just for the, and I don't want to say everybody's converted, obviously they're not, but I'm saying that they're much more, it's much more open than Turkey would be as far as the Iranian people in general. As far as their reluctance to Christianity is much less than you would have in Turkey or most of the Arab world.
Like over the years, what do you think about the Christian effort to spread the gospel in Muslim lands? Tell us a little bit, like what's happening, because it feels like sometimes we get into this like dichotomy. It's like, hey, either people think like, hey, you know, they believe what they believe. We just leave them alone. It's like this relativistic point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, Islam is this same religion as us, or, you know, we all believe in the same God. It's like when people criticize Islam, they bunch all the Muslims together along with Islam, instead of thinking that like most of these people are born into this religion, right? Just like, you know, people are privileged to be born in America and have this freedom and just get up and go to a church if they want to, you know? So I try to tell people that the first victim of Islam is the Muslims, right? Mm-hmm. Like before, you know, before it even comes, because most of these people don't have even the choice. So as Christians, as people who are charged with the Great Commission, like how do we respond? Like, as far as you've known this for 40 years, like what can you tell us?
Well, I think that's really a very challenging question, Daria. I'll tell you what, because evangelical Christians go out as couples generally in their small families, and they go to a land and they're supported. Sometimes they're accused of being supported by the government. They're definitely not. No government wants to see Christians evangelizing Muslims. Mm-hmm. It's done by private individuals and by churches. We'll send a young couple to a Muslim country like Turkey or all across the Arab world. They learn the language with much difficulty. It usually takes years, and try to do good with when they can and try to spread the message of Jesus. It's interesting to me that in Istanbul on the main street there, and I know you've been there, there's this church called San Antoine. It's a Catholic church that is probably the most known church in Turkey. It's probably the one church you could say everybody knows where it is. It's right on Istiklal Caddesi. one of the major thoroughfares. And
it's the
hundreds
only
of
one
people
that's open to the public.
It's open to the public.
Yeah.
And it's open a lot. A lot of the other churches are open only for Mass, and they're hardly ever open. Most Protestants do not have their own church buildings. They do. They're on a back street somewhere, in a small storefront or in a rented shop or in their home, where this one Catholic church is wide open to everybody. And hundreds of people visit it every day. Hundreds. And mm-hmm. they see things that they don't believe in the Quran. They see Jesus on a cross, for example. And they see statues of different saints. Of course, Islam just forbids pictures and of holy people. And yet they're there, and they pray to these, and they light candles. So there's a hunger deep down there. And so what I often say is, in one sense, the evangelical Protestants are there with their families trying to get a foothold. And then these people are coming to the Catholic Church. And so my prayer has been, we've got to get together and pray and unite. And yes, there are differences between Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox Christians. We know that they're not all going to practice the same. But let's quit fighting and be a united witness to Jesus. We all believe he died on the cross. We all believe he rose from the dead. If we do have some differences in practice, can't we come together and rejoice when a Turk or somebody becomes Catholic? Or can't we rejoice when they become evangelical? Can't we rejoice when a small percentage probably would become Orthodox? And rejoice, and then they can decide what's the best sect for them. They can always go, toward one of the other groups if they find that they preach the truth more careful, better. But the point is simply is that you have the structure in place. I think with the Orthodox or Catholics, they have the buildings, they have the long-term presence in Turkey, but they're usually the ones that are out trying to evangelize and winning the friends. That's usually done by, it seems like it's done more by evangelicals. So that's not totally, So I would hope there'd be a lot of young people. I mean, we need monks and nuns too, but I think there's also a need for young families, young Catholic families to move to Muslim countries and witness to Christ as well. And so that's kind of where the passion of my heart is. I'll give one example real quick here. When I moved to one city, I don't mean you may mention the city just for security reasons, a very, very sensitive city in Turkey where I was watched constantly. People could not figure out why would we live in this one city when there's so many beautiful places in Turkey to live. Why go to the city in the middle of a civil war in that? And long story short, I went to the only church that was still in town. It was an old church. It goes back to the second century. And as I went to that church, it took quite a while, but the priest eventually said, "You're not here to make us Protestants, are you?" I said, "No, I'm not. Why would I want? I don't want to make you Protestant. I wanted to see the local people come to faith in Christ." He said, "Well, let me tell you, there's a man that's been coming to me for about 6 months now. And he asked me for a Bible. I was afraid to give it to him. I thought for sure he was a spy and he's going to get me in trouble. But I went ahead and gave it to him. He's read it cover to cover about 14, 15 times," he said, "the New Testament." Then he asked for the Old Testament. He started reading that as well. And I can't do anything with him because I can't baptize him like that, but perhaps you can. And so I ended up, working with this man and his family, and a lot of other people came to faith. Now there's a thriving church in that city, and it's right across the street from the old city, the old church that goes back to the second century. And only a few families left. All those other families have either, long ago left the region in history that allowed them to convert to Islam, of course, but across, there's a church full of all Muslim background believers, and they worship in the local languages, Turkish and Kurdish. They sing Turkish and Kurdish hymns that they've written, and it's a powerful expression of the body. And so now that's spread to another city, too, where they have an existing church. It goes back way, way back to an old monastery. And I said, "Why are let's work together?" And they're doing that in that city as well. So I think that my heart would just be that we could unite together as followers of Christ and not divide over the things that divide Western Christians, and not just among Catholics and Protestants, evangelicals, even among Protestants, there's thousands of different ways of practice out there. And Catholics, there's other kinds of issues, but let's unite together and pray with one another and seek to make a united witness to Christ. And I believe, and I'll say that one last thing. I think, Dari, I believe in truth, power, and love are the three things. That a Muslim has to encounter the truth that Jesus really did die on the cross and rose from the dead. He's got to have a power encounter. She has to have a power. Almost always, it's going to take something supernatural to make them make that kind of decision. That's going to cost them in Turkey, it may not cost their lives. It has, but not so many. But it probably costs them their family, maybe their job, their friends. It's going to cost them something. Some countries, it's death instantly. In many Muslim countries, but in Turkey, I wouldn't say it's usually death, but it is certainly, you know, a lot of social pressure, a lot of isolation. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing, of course, is most important. That's love. It almost always begins with loving relationships. So those three things working together, truth, power, and love, is what I wanted to see. To foreigners that come and Turkish believers just flooded with those areas where they can speak the truth. They can pray and trust God for the miraculous showing up of people, you know, a supernatural event in their life, a dream, a vision, an apparition of Mary. That's happened to a lot of people where they've seen Mary in a special appearing to them. And then, of course, the loving relationship is the passion of my life.
Yeah, and then we have to have the sacraments. So we have to have priests go there. Like, I mean, you know, it's, and obviously there's so much power and grace, mm-hmm. In baptism and confirmation and the Eucharist. You know, it's, you cannot evangelize without those. But as you say, now it's such a different time that the laities need to be part of it as well. And I am eternally grateful to Protestants. Mm-hmm. Who are still willing to evangelize Muslims. I mean, if it were up to Catholics, I don't know where I would be. You know, like they've been doing this for decades, and there's no reason we can't learn from them and or work with them. And one of the things, as you were mentioning, it's so different, Protestant Christianity, like the evangelical arm of Protestant Christianity than Islam, is that it's just almost like, for me, I was part of a more charismatic group, which is like quite a few of them are. It just felt so foreign, even though I was an atheist, like it didn't feel like worshiping God. Mm-hmm. And I felt a lot more comfortable in a Catholic church. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I attended a Melkite rite, Divine Liturgy. Have you ever been to one?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have. Yeah.
And that felt so like, oh, this is the liturgy we can evangelize to Muslims with. Even though I am like, I love the Latin Mass, and somehow something happened and I am really Romanized it. Like, I am never like a big fan of Divine Liturgy myself, but when I went there, I felt like the music, even the incense, like everything felt familiar. So it would be almost like, you present something familiar to these people for whom so much is changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's rhythmic, it's cyclical. So it's not so foreign. That's one of the things, like Christianity feels like it's from a different planet. You know, it mm-hmm. just feels so different sometimes. So as you say, like, I think there's just so much room for us to work together.
And I think, Jerry, I think you said it very well. I think with a lot of people, Turks that are raised on global youth culture, they may feel those, even though I like when they write their own songs. I don't like the Western translated songs as much, but some of the Turks love those ones that they call them Hillsong, are very popular evangelical across the evangelical world. And they translate those into Turkish, and a lot of people love those songs. They can sit by a girl they like, for example, and they don't have to. In other words, there's some Western cultural adaptation that a lot of Turks respond to. Now, I love the Catholic way of worship, you know, and I agree with you about the Eucharist. I think you're probably going to end up seeing some Turks, you know, or other Muslims respond both ways. Some are going to respond to the more contemporary way of worship that's kind of dominates the evangelical world, and others will be drawn, like you are, to the more of a liturgical path and a more of a Catholic worship. Peter Kreeft, the brilliant Catholic apologist, and I think he's written 80 books, and in his 80s, he talks about I love his phrase that Catholics, the evangelicals have the fire and Catholics have the fireplace. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. The evangelicals have come with a lot of zeal, but they don't always have the right borderline to put it in. And so some of that, whereas Catholics, a lot of times they have the fireplace, or Orthodox, but they don't have the fire to go out and evangelize. I think it's, some have misread some of the Vatican II documents that that even though it expresses a lot of empathy and a lot of good in Islam, it never says you should not evangelize. But I think a lot of people have read it. We don't have to worry about them anymore. You know, it's right. Dialogue is the goal, not evangelization. When dialogue becomes the goal, it's easy for us. We don't have to worry about evangelizing, but that's not the goal. I mean, the best thing you can do to anybody is give them Jesus. And right. So why are so many Christians content with dialogue or not doing anything? It's like, well, we don't want to tell them. They have their own faith. Well, why would you not want to tell them the greatest news that ever happened? You know, that doesn't make sense. I mean, we've got the best news. We got the best story. Everybody's better off with Jesus than they are without him. So why are we ashamed when we have to go around saying, well, we're dialogued enough, or leave them alone. They got their own faith, you know?
No, I agree. And it's kind of upsetting how it's changed, because, you know, completely good news completely turned my life around. I want that for everybody, not just for me, of course, you know. And living under Islam is not a happy place. It's easier to say from here, it's like, let them live their own lives. But it's not like, you know, it's not like everybody's happy, especially women. Why wouldn't you bless these nations with what, you know, what we have? Christianity, obviously. Before we finish, I want to talk about the Marian apparitions. You kind of touched onto it, and I want to talk about it a little more. So why are there so many supernatural incidents like visions and dreams and apparitions in Muslim lands?
Well, I think that's a great question, Daria. I think this is something that I especially hope women would be drawn to. I spoke at a conference just last Saturday, and I read two verses from the Bible and two verses from the Quran, and see which ones, ask the people which ones which. I'm gonna, for the sake of time, I won't read the ones from the Bible. I'm gonna assume everybody would know those. But listen, these are two very short verses from the Quran. Mary said, "My Lord, how can I have a son and a man has not yet touched me?" He said, "Even though so, God creates what he pleases. When he decrees a matter, he only says be, and it is." And probably the most challenging verse, and one of the most challenging. And mention when the angel said, "Oh, Mary, indeed, God has chosen you and purified you and chosen you above the women of the world. Oh, Mary, be devoutly obedient to your Lord and prostrate and bow with those who bow in prayer." A Turkish writer, actually Mustafa Akyol, who's a very contemporary Turkish writer. I like him a lot in a lot of ways, although he misunderstands, you know, Jesus fully. He tells a story, of course, is well known, that when Muhammad smashed hundreds of idols in the Kaaba, where the Muslims prayed toward Mecca, he spared only the frescoes of Jesus and his mother. And of course, there's an expression in the Quran about their hadith, their traditions, not in the Quran, but in the most authoritative book outside the Quran, are called the hadith. "A child therefore cries loudly at the time of birth because of the touch of Satan, except for Mary and her child." And so Mary is highly revered in Islam. She's the most highly revered woman in all of Islam. She's the only woman to have a chapter of the Quran, of the 114 chapters. She's the only woman to have a chapter in the Quran named after her. Now, I wanted to understand this very clearly. She is not seen as the mother of God. She is not seen as the mother of a divine son. Let's be very clear on that. I don't want to overdo the fact that Muslims respect her. They do not worship her, but she is very highly honored. And so with that in mind, a lot of times there are either apparitions of Mary, like what's happened in Zaytun, Egypt, where over a million Egyptians, over half, most of them Muslim, has actually saw an image of her over a Coptic church where they saw her in the light. And it happened over a period of about 2 or 3 years that literally hundreds of thousands of people saw. It was on Egyptian TV, very widely seen. And that happened 3 other times in Egypt alone, at least. And I think one reason why it happened there was so much because the Christians have been so oppressed by the Muslim majority. And all the times where Mary appeared, it brought peace. You know, and so it's like God stood up and said, you know, "Hey, you both honor me, Mary. And so let's quit this fighting, this terrible oppression." Other places, it's more like I mentioned earlier, where San Antoine Church in Istanbul, I would say that's an apparition, but it's a place where people can go and they'll pray to Mary, especially if a woman cannot have a child. I mean, barrenness is a terrible terrible thing for a woman to go through in a Muslim country. She's meant to have a lot of children. Like, Terry, you're a good example, even though you're a good Catholic. I mean, you know, you're having five children is wonderful. I know, that's what Muslims would want. And there's so many places like that throughout the Muslim world where people have gone. The Lady of Lebanon is one. There's, of course, Fatima in Portugal, and that's a whole story. I don't know if we have time to get into that, but if we do, I can mention that a little bit. But there's a number of places like that, that both where Mary's appeared, and also there's other places where she just, her presence is known. Ephesus, for example, is a very, I know you've seen this, Daria. Ephesus is where John took Mary after the cross. Let me rephrase that. When Jesus was on the cross, he told John to take care of his mother. And so the story goes that John took Mary to Ephesus, and she was lived there and for many, many years. And, you know, whether she was buried there or not is a point of not contention so much, but, you know, that's unknown. But there's outside of that, there's a wall that stretches for several blocks with tens of thousands of prayer intentions in it. And they're usually written on a cloth or a paper, and they're stuffed inside these little gaps in the brick or in the stone. And it's, you know, you can just see the desperation of people. You know, oh, Mary, please, I must give me a child. Oh, Mary, please help my son win university. Oh, Mary, please keep my, you know, my husband faithful. You know, you just see the need on their people. And so Mary is highly revered, and sometimes she just shows up in people's lives just as Jesus does in dreams and visions. It's a powerful thing that the mother of God, which was actually formed in Ephesus, the idea of the Theotokos, Mary is the mother of God, was first expressed at the Council of Ephesus. And that's where this great wall is, with so many prayer requests are in Ephesus. So yes, Muslims would not believe that Jesus is divine, but they will often seek help from his mother. And that's why I think one reason why Mary goes out of her way to show up in people's lives. Ultimately, the goal is to bring them to her son. And we only God knows, Daria, how many. And I asked the Egyptian priest about this very thing yesterday. He says, how many conversions did the apparitions in Egypt lead to? He says, no one knows. I'm sure, you know, it could be in the tens of thousands as far as we know. Now, they're all appearances, they're still Muslim. They can't just come out and declare themselves Christians. Okay. But who knows how many believe in their hearts believe in Jesus as divine and believe, you know, have found Christ in some way, even though on all appearances they cannot express it openly. And there's places like that all throughout the Muslim world where I believe Muslims are discovering the Blessed Mother, and the Blessed Mother then eventually will point them to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always think, you know, when people ask you about Mary, and the funny thing is, I think Muhammad put the verses about Mary, like, because he always refers Jesus, son of Mary, Jesus, son of Mary, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that is the reason that she's the most mentioned woman in the Quran, mm-hmm. because he always wanted to emphasize the humanity of Jesus to kind of quell those arguments about him being divine. Right, but I always thought that that's kind of a mysterious way of Our Lady inserting herself in the Quran, because, you know, because she knows it's going to go through her, as you say. Because, like, I mean, despite everything, she's kind of the bridge between, you know, for Muslims to cross over to Christianity. And I think one of these days I'm praying that she's going to pull a Guadalupe and convert all the Muslims. So mm-hmm. I'm just kind of waiting that's going to happen. But that, like, that apparition in Zaytun, and I, you know, I learned about it just a couple of years ago. I had no idea. And it's like, I was fascinated by it, because they actually have pictures of the apparition. So it's not like, you know, it looks like her. I mean, it's just amazing. And apparently she healed so many people, and people would gather when, under the church for hours, and she would just hover over this church. I mean, how can you get over something like that? Mm-hmm. As you say, even if you didn't convert because of fear, or you converted in your heart, but you're afraid to come out, like, you know, that's going to leave a mark. So we don't even know how many Christians there are, at the end of the day in these lands. But Yeah, so Our Lady is, you know, is in charge, and she's going to get things done because, you know, we are not doing a very good job for the time being.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a bishop, Bishop Sheen, you know, in the 50s, he said this way before Islam was, in the, even long before I discovered how important Islam was, he said in the 50s that why, you know, you look at Portugal, of all the places in the world where the apparition of Fatima took place, it took place in a village called after Fatima, who is Madinah Muhammad's daughter, his beloved daughter. And this woman, a young girl, she was more of a girl than a real woman, I guess, depending on age, when the Reconquista took place and the Spaniards took Islam, Spain back from Islam and made it Catholic again, she had converted and she married a young man who was a Catholic, and they became Christ followers, and she died kind of young, and he named a village after her, Fatima. It's probably the only village in Portugal named after a Muslim, or, you know, and that's the very place where the three children had their apparition, their visions of Mary. And of course that's a whole long story. Just to abbreviate it, they predicted World War II. They predicted the takeover of communism. They predicted a number of things. They had no idea. They were all young. They didn't even know what these things were, but they spelled it out. There was, you know, all kinds of apparitions took place, all kinds of miraculous things took place. But Bishop Sheen back in 52 said, it's probably going to be Muslims discovering Mary that's going to be the bridge to Muslims. He said, no, we're, you know, Islam's the only religion that hasn't just faded after a time. It gets stronger. Where the other things that surfaced have all faded and gone away. Islam has lasted. And he said, it's probably going to take the Blessed Mother to bring Muslims to discover her son. And so, you know, I don't know. That's the only way. I think a lot of times Jesus shows up, you know, we hear all kinds of stories of Jesus showing up in people's dreams, Muslim dreams. And I can tell stories all night about people, you know, have come to faith through a miraculous way. But it's unique too that Mary is known, a lot of her tombs and her shrines are pretty open to people. And so it's not just she's discoverable by a lot of people. And so when they can't get pregnant, and then after they go to this, they visit a shrine, the woman is pregnant, or, you know, when somebody isn't healed and they go to a shrine or they see an apparition, they're healed. Those kind of things make a huge impact on people. And even if they don't right away come out and say, oh, I'm a follower of Christ now, only God knows. And I believe what we're going to see, Daria, we're going to see a lot of these people that were forced to be converted to Islam, that have Armenian, Greek, Assyrian, Arab ancestry, are going to start looking for their faith, their ancestral faith. They're going to start looking for the faith that their ancestors believed in. And that's what we've been praying for the last 40 years. In fact, we have an all-night prayer meeting coming up this weekend. We're going to pray 24 hours straight for Muslims to come to know Jesus at my school. And it's pretty powerful. We tune in with people around the world and they turn in, they call in their prayer requests, and we pray for them. And it's a marathon, but we've seen God do great things that way. And we're trusting that he'll move powerfully. And there's so many people that are praying for Muslims now out of love, not out of hatred or fear, but just out of love. They want to see Muslims discover the Jesus and his mother. And that's what gives me encouragement. Even after all these 40 years of sometimes being very discouraged, there's also some great encouragement that comes along.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. I love the idea of all night prayer. And one day it will be, Lord willing, an all-night adoration for Muslims. That's, one of the things is lacking in the Catholic Church, this like ardent desire to evangelize, you know. So I'm really hoping some of that Protestant fire is going to jump over to our side. And I think things started to stir off and everything is getting better. But it's just so exciting to hear that people are still praying for the lands who don't know Christ. So, but
that's when God raised up Daria Little.
Thank you. He's being too good to me. And, you know, I don't deserve all the gifts he has given me, and I can only give a little back, but he takes our tiny little and makes mountains out of it. So, you know, he doesn't ask for much. So we all can do something little. I mean, we have the internet now. You don't even need to leave your home to evangelize. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like 50, 60 years ago that there was no way of reaching these people. I get so many emails from people asking about Christ. Like, you know, we have a lot more tools to reach people. But That's it for me. Those are the questions I had for you. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Is your book out yet, or is it still in the works?
I'm still working on it. I hope it'll be pretty soon. Yeah. Okay. The one that we talked about, some of the things we talked about are from, I've written, but I'm trying to put the final chapter together and summarize it all. And that's been a challenge. And then of course, more editing always is a nonstop work.
Indeed.
Editing is, even for a native speaker like myself, I still find editing very, very challenging, And
for editors, and I think people who edit what I write is that they have an extra jewel in their crown when they get to heaven.
You probably write better than I do. No, it's not your mother language. You probably write English better than I do, I'm sure.
Yeah, I still don't get the de. Isn't that awful? We don't have de in Turkey as as an article. So I kind of wing it where it goes. So hey, getting better after all these years. But anyway, yeah, thank you very much. And thanks for coming on the show today. This was wonderful, very informative. And I'm really looking forward to reading your book. I'll definitely plug it in once it's out. I love people to read it, because from the chapters I read, the samples you sent me, it's very readable. It doesn't bog you down in this crazy history. It's very readable and interesting, and may it reach to many people and may it sell millions.
Well, that would be a miracle. But thank you, Daria. I appreciate you so much. I've read your book twice. Your story, and I've mentioned you numbers of times to people, and you're very inspiring to me. And you personify, you were led to faith by evangelicals, but you went deeper into the Eucharist and into the sacraments. And so, I think that is something that we'll probably see a lot more of in the days ahead, as Catholics being evangelized more, and as more Protestants probably discover that they need more of a sacramental understanding of Christ. I think we'll see more and more people, may follow you in that. But I know we just want them to discover Jesus. That's the main thing.
Yes, you're right. Lord willing, and we'll be praying for that. So thank you very much again. And thank you very much for listening. Please let me know what you think. And I'm on all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And subscribe to the podcast and comment. And I'd love to hear your thoughts again. Let's live a little and bring more of us to life together. Thank you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.